Good morning. I want to welcome you. I first want to apologize on behalf of the court that we are starting late, but Madison had traffic issues this morning, apparently, not on the side of the street, side of the town that I live on, but did, and therefore we had to start our conference late, which has pushed us over, so it's our fault and we are sorry. The other thing I want to tell you is that at 11 o'clock, and it's close to 10, and this oral argument would ordinarily last an hour, maybe a bit more, at 11 o'clock, there is a fire alarm testing. It's the first Wednesday of the month. So it is a very annoying sound, and all proceedings have to stop because ordinarily, if it tests well, you can't hear anything. So we will, if we're still in session, continue after we hear silence from the alarm system, okay? I tell you all that, and after I know it for many years on Wednesday, you will see me jump when I get to the alarm because I have forgotten that it will be off. But do not leave the building, okay? Because of the fire alarm. You can leave thereafter. All right. Let me first welcome students here. Students come with a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to join us for an oral argument. And if they accept the invitation, they get material about the case. They may do extra activities in the classroom relating to the case, come to oral argument, and a justice of the court is assigned each day to meet with the students during the lunch hour. The discussion is on the procedure of the court in taking cases and deciding cases, not the substantive issues of the case involved. Everyone is invited to join the students in that discussion, which will be afternoon right here in the courtroom. Now, if anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, raise your hand and the marshal will give you a summary. Okay. Since all of you are prepared, I'll introduce the members of the court. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. Seated to my left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and Justice Crooks is the justice with whom the students and others will meet today. Seated next to Justice Crooks is Justice Patience Robinsack, and seated next to her is Justice Michael Gableman. Starting at the other end of the court, you're already raised your hand? Okay.
Yes. I'm the other end.
Justice Ziegler. And seated next to her is Justice David Prosser, and to my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And let me introduce the students, who I nearly forgot in all the announcements I had to make, and they are from Kewaskum High School. And would they please stand so we can all meet them? Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. I'll call our first case, which is 08-AP-1139, State versus Omer Ninham. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Ninham is Brian Stevenson. He's going to be introduced by Attorney Peter Sean Moreno. Counsel?
To the court. My name is Peter Moreno, local counsel for Omer Ninham. I'm appearing today for the limited purpose of introducing out-of-state counsel Brian Stevenson. Mr. Stevenson will be presenting oral argument on Mr. Ninham's behalf.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Stevenson, welcome to Wisconsin. You're admitted to the bar of Alabama. And in good standing, you are welcome to appear pro hoc vici in this case. And we hope you like it so much you'll stay here forever, if not longer.
Well, thank you. Chief Justice Abrahamson. My name is Brian Stevenson, along with Peter Moreno. We represent the defendant, appellant petitioner in this case, Omer Ninnem. Omer is the youngest child in the state of Wisconsin to be sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. His death in prison sentence for a crime he was accused of when he was 14 years of age puts Wisconsin in the small minority of jurisdictions that have imposed death in prison sentences for children 14 and younger. There are only 18 states in this country where a child of 14 has been sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. Because Omer is the only child of this age with this sentence in Wisconsin.
How many states permit such a sentence under their statutes?
There are about 30 states, Justice Gableman, that have transfer statutes that expose children, some as young as 6 years of age, to sentences like life imprisonment without parole. But this sentence has only been applied in these 18 states, and there are no states where legislatures have expressly authorized a sentence of life imprisonment without parole for a child of 14. That's important to our argument because the state has argued that the legislature has endorsed this kind of sentence. We don't think that that's established by the statutes. What has happened in Wisconsin...
But if I understand your response, in 30 out of the 50, it is possible.
It is possible. That's correct.
Thank you.
That's correct. The United States Supreme Court has held that the exposure to these possible sentences based on transfer laws, et cetera, is not a proper basis for making a determination that these sentences have been expressly authorized. And the absence of these sentences in the great majority of states is relevant to what the court has deemed to be critical to how a court evaluates a question about the constitutionality of such a sentence. In the last 6 years, the United States Supreme Court has held that children, because of their developmental status, are entitled to constitutional protections when it comes to particular kinds of sentences. In 2005, in Roper versus Simmons, the Supreme Court held, even in cases involving very aggravated homicides, that the developmental status of children, their inability to kind of make good decisions, their impulse control, their capacity for change, their subjectivity and influence to peer pressure, shields them from a sentence of death, the death penalty. And in 2005, the court struck down the death penalty for juveniles, even in these very aggravated murder cases.
What was the sentence in that case then? If they struck down the death penalty, what was the sentence in Roper for that homicide?
Under Missouri statute, that juvenile was automatically sentenced to life imprisonment without parole.
Okay, the sentence that we're talking about here.
That's correct. And the question of the propriety of life without parole for a juvenile was not expressly addressed until this past term, when the analysis that the court engaged in Roper, and that was the judgment of the lower courts in this case, the lower courts took the position that the Roper decision applied only when we're talking about the death penalty. But, of course, this past term in Graham versus Florida, the United States Supreme Court made clear that no, the status of children and the protections that are afforded to children under our Constitution are also implicated by a sentence of life imprisonment without parole. In Graham, which involved a juvenile convicted of a non-homicide, the court held that juvenile status and the severity of a sentence of life without parole rendered such a sentence violative of the Eighth Amendment. The United States Supreme Court has not expressly addressed the question of life without parole for a juvenile convicted of a homicide, and certainly not a 14-year-old, and that's why this becomes a question of first impression for this court. However, the Supreme Court has said to the court how this court should evaluate this question. And what the court has said is that when addressing a categorical challenge to a sentence of life imprisonment without parole for a juvenile, the first thing the court must address is objective indicia about whether such a sentence is unusual, rare, in that category of sentences that the court has found to be prohibited by the Eighth Amendment. We have submitted evidence that absolutely puts the question of life without parole for a 14-year-old in the category of cases that the court has struck down. We've documented 73 instances where children 14 and younger have been sentenced to life without parole. There are 18 jurisdictions where these sentences have been imposed. These numbers, 18 and 73, are very much consistent with the kinds of numbers that the court has found to be insufficient to establish the kind of consensus necessary to uphold similar sentences. In Roper, we were talking about 20 jurisdictions with about 72 juveniles sentenced to death. In Atkins, we were talking about 20 jurisdictions. Atkins is the case that dealt with the death penalty for people with mental retardation, 20 jurisdictions, about 70 people subject to that sentence. In Graham, we were similarly talking about 130 juveniles sentenced to life without parole for non-homicides, with actually a larger number of jurisdictions where the sentence was possible, but about a half dozen jurisdictions where the sentences had actually been imposed. So the data about the rareness, the unusualness of this sentence puts the argument and the question presented in this case, in Ninham, very much in line with the cases that the court has found to be violative of the Eighth Amendment, notably Roper versus Simmons, Graham versus Florida, Atkins versus Virginia, Kennedy versus Louisiana.
Mr. Stevenson, let me ask you a question about the focus of the age. My understanding is that the U.S. Supreme Court in Roper and in Graham was focusing on the age at the time of the commission of the crime. I'm wondering if you think that that makes sense, or if the focus should be on the age of the person convicted at the time of sentencing. Does it make a difference? Should it make a difference?
I don't think it should make a difference, Your Honor. I think that age at the time of the offense is the relevant factor. It's the way almost every jurisdiction assesses eligibility for a particular kind of prosecution. Transfer, direct status, the kind of treatment protocols that are established all turn on the age of the offender at the time the crime is committed. And that's ultimately because, no matter how old they are at the time of sentencing, we are judging them for their behavior and their culpability at the time that crime takes place. And so I think for a variety of reasons, that is the right way to think about it. It's not uncommon, frankly, in juvenile cases, particularly cases involving kids who are 13 and 14, for there to be a fairly substantial period of time before the case actually goes to trial and to sentencing. That has to do a lot of times with the different things that go on for juveniles that are distinct from adults. It has a lot to do with the inability of many young kids to prepare themselves for an adult prosecution. And so it's actually more likely that a young person is going to be older at the time of sentencing than an adult would be. We don't think that that should be a factor that weighs against them for the purposes of assessing culpability. And virtually every jurisdiction makes the question of how children are treated for the purposes of prosecution and sentencing relevant based on their age at the time of the offense. Much like we think about mental status. If someone was insane at the time of the crime, but not insane at the time of sentencing, it wouldn't do anything to mitigate the fact that they should be shielded from full criminal responsibility. And a whole range of other things apply in that way as well.
Let me follow through a little bit. In this particular case, it's my understanding that defense counsel recommended a sentence to Judge McKay of parole eligibility after 25 years. Now, what if Judge McKay, instead of 25 years, had said, okay, parole eligibility here would be 75 years? Would you still be here making a similar argument today?
We would, Your Honor. That would effectively...
Excuse me. You would or would not?
We would. Such a sentence would effectively be a virtual sentence of life imprisonment without parole. Because parole eligibility for someone who is 15 or 14 after 75 years would exceed their life expectancy. It would be the kind of virtual life sentence. That's not our situation, obviously, but I do think that the Supreme Court in Graham has recognized that courts and lower courts should not end run these constitutional protections by simply creating other formulations of life imprisonment without parole. A judge could impose a sentence of 130 years, and because the judge doesn't use the word life imprisonment without parole, one might argue that that's a different kind of sentence. But as a practical matter, it's not. In Graham, what the court required is that states create a, quote, meaningful possibility of release for those juveniles that are now exempt from life without parole sentences. And that's what we think the Constitution requires. That would not be adequately addressed by a sentence of 75 years or something much longer than that. That's not to say, Justice Crooks, that there is a constitutional requirement that a juvenile like Omer Ninnem be released. That's not our argument. Our argument is that there be this possibility for release, and that's why the sentence recommended by the defendant in this case would have been consistent with what we're arguing the Eighth Amendment requires, which is some recognition about the capacity of children to change. What's problematic about the sentence the judge posed here is he said that Omer was irretrievably damaged in a way that he could never recover, never be reformed. And that's simply not true. What we know about children who are 13 and 14 years of age is that they will change. All kids change.
Counselor, do studies that you rely on have any foundation with children who are incarcerated at those ages? Seems to me they would develop differently in an incarcerated situation than they would in a family home.
It's a very insightful question, Justice. But yes, some of the studies do. A lot of the studies have actually looked at kids in both juvenile and adult systems and assessing their maturation and assessing their development and come to the same conclusions. While there are kids who develop negatively in these environments, and I don't think there's any dispute about that, you cannot predict which kids will develop negatively and which kids will develop positively based on their offense or based on the picture that is presented by these children when they're 13 and 14. And what's interesting about some of these studies is that when experts try to predict which kids are going to show the kind of antisocial and negative personality features that are projected on them when they're 14 and 15, they're consistently wrong. In fact, one of the studies suggests that they're wrong 85% of the time. And that's at the heart of why the Supreme Court has condemned and prohibited these kinds of permanent, unalterable judgments imposed on children who are not permanent yet, who are not finished alterations, who are in the midst of a very explosive and very dynamic process of maturation to which there are no clear outcomes at the age at which they're being sentenced.
Counsel, what are the studies that you're talking about? Tell me which ones. Where are they cited? Because I'm interested in that. I'm a mother of two boys, 11 and 13, and I'm telling you, there are days when I hope the decisions they make right now aren't the ones they're going to make 10 years from now. So I buy into the brain development theory.
Or at least we have hope.
at least in part. Okay, but you know, these are serious, horrific offenses that are committed here to a child the same age. And, you know, in Wisconsin, at least, we have victim rights laws, and we need to hear and listen to the victim and the impact on the community and the impact on the families. And it's not just looking at one side of the equation. There are a variety of factors sentencing judges consider: the gravity of the offense, the character of the offender, the need to protect the public, and the different factors that come into play in real human life. Yeah. It's not just the brain development of the juvenile that's going to hold the day here. So you have to help me with this.
Sure.
How do we know that this juvenile, who spends life essentially, or many, 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 many years in an adult prison, is someone whose brain is going to develop like the people you're talking about in the study?
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. Let me just say, if I could, something general and then something more specific that might be helpful to you. What we now know, that we really didn't know 15 years ago, is that what happens with adolescents, and this includes your kids and my kids and all kids, is that when they get to this age, 13, 14, the parts of the brain that are uninhibited, that are looking for sensations, that are risk-taking, it's the amygdala. Those parts are actually developing much faster than the parts of the brain, the frontal lobes, that actually create kind of thinking three steps ahead.
I understand all that.
So that's the general analysis. It's in the research by Dr. Kaufman and Dr. Steinberg in our brief. Those are the research documents that I would direct the court to that have the most utility.
Social factors have nothing to do with decision-making. It's purely brain development. That's it. End of the analysis. It doesn't matter what neighborhood you live in, what your family's like, socioeconomic factors, behavioralist theory is out the window.
No, absolutely not, Your Honor. In fact, all of those things are incredibly relevant and have a huge impact on what happens to these kids. And that's in the research that cited by the MPSA, Wisconsin Psychological Association, and Wisconsin Psychiatric Association. What we know is that for kids like Omer, who are in the margins, who are coming out of dysfunctional families that are chaotic and violent, and where there's alcoholism, where there's no kind of intervention, where there's no kind of help in managing this kind of overdeveloped socio-emotional control system with the lack of impulsivity and the lack of thinking things through, those kids are at much greater risk of acting out and doing things that are destructive and doing things that are violent. Omer Nenum was somebody who was consuming alcohol, abusing alcohol in the fifth grade. By the time he was 13 years of age, he was drinking until he was unconscious. There was no intervention to help him. Alcoholism, we also know, increases the likelihood of these kinds of behaviors. So these social factors, these economic factors, are very relevant to what happens to these kids. But it doesn't mean that those kids can't recover. The expert that evaluated Omer Nenum 7 years after he was sent to an adult prison has testified or gave a statement, an affidavit, that says his adjustment has actually been very good. The kind of dysfunctional, the kind of delusional thinking, it's in our affidavit attached to the appendix, that was so evident when he was 14 and 15, is now not there. His adjustment in prison has been positive. And that's the reason why I believe we can say, for this child, the prognosis is very good.
So you're saying actually the prison setting for him has created better ability for him to make mature decisions and develop to be a functional human than living the life that he lived in his family home.
That's right. And that's why our argument isn't that kids of this age can never be prosecuted as adults, can never be subject to adult prosecution and incarceration. That's not our argument. I think for some kids, particularly in the absence of the kind of interventions that they need, these kinds of interventions may be their only hope. But to say to this child, or to any child at 14, that we know enough about what's going to happen to you that you will never be capable of reintroduction into society, of recovery, that's what the court, both in Roper and in Graham, including cases and offenders that have pretty bad histories. I mean, the crime in Roper is a really awful crime. It's a horrific crime. The crimes in Graham. Graham was a 16-year-old who committed a very aggravated, violent felony, was put on probation, then committed another felony. And that's what led to his sentence of life imprisonment without parole. So the courts appreciate that this population, these kids, are frequently dealing with barriers and challenges that other kids don't deal with. They also appreciate the problems that have been created, the tragic violence that has been created. And let me be the first to say, we would not say anything to minimize the tragic consequences of this behavior, of this horrific crime that resulted in the life of a 13-year-old child. It is interesting and relevant that it's classic juvenile crime. It's the kind of misguided, foolish bullying that escalates into a tragedy, that escalates into death. It doesn't minimize the severity of the crime, but it's relevant when you're thinking about the differences between adult crimes and juvenile crimes. In Wisconsin, life without parole is the harshest sentence that we impose. It's what we would give to a serial murderer. It's what we would give to someone who's committed lots and lots of crimes over a long period of time without the deficits that children have compared to adults. It's the reason why the court has said that you cannot compare the culpability of a child with the culpability of an adult. While it's true that there are very important retributive goals that have to be satisfied, they're not satisfied when we don't adequately respect the status of children. And again, here, we don't have to kind of take a risk. Our argument is that he should be eligible for parole, that he should be eligible for the kind of evaluation that might allow him to establish that he's one of those kids who evolved into the kind of person for whom release would be possible. That's not something we have to kind of prejudge, as the judge did in this case. And that's what the Supreme Court is saying in Graham, that these kinds of prejudgments for very young adolescents is what is violative of the constitutional norms and principles that the Eighth Amendment represents.
But, counsel,
certainly.
As I understand it, you're looking at punishment from the front end. You're not so concerned about whether someone actually spends their life in prison and dies in prison. It's the front end possibility that someone could be released. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't say we have no concern. We actually believe that many of these children, consistent with the research, will become the kinds of people for whom release is quite legitimate and quite probable. And in my experience,
once this theory is plays out, you could see the Eighth Amendment language of punishment being applied to someone who is serving a lengthy sentence, but you believe has had this brain development and has had this rehabilitation and should be released.
I don't think that the Constitution has made a recognition that all sentencing, all punishment has to follow along a particular course of thinking. That's not the argument. I think that the Eighth Amendment has aligned itself in very narrow ways with particularly extreme sentences. And right now, our jurisprudence only establishes that these protections apply in the category of sentences that are the death penalty and life imprisonment without parole. And we do that because those are permanent, unalterable judgments. I think someone serving a 40-year sentence might argue that I think that's a harsh sentence, that's an appropriate sentence, but nothing in Roper, nothing in Graham, nothing in the court's Eighth Amendment jurisprudence would offer relief to that person because they will have that opportunity for recovery. The other factor that I think is relevant here is that we have hundreds, thousands of people serving 20, 30, 40-year sentences. There is no objective indicia that would suggest that those kinds of sentences are unusual. And consequently, those kinds of sentences will not satisfy the Eighth Amendment's requirements that prohibit cruel and unusual punishments.
You're looking for a categorical rule here, are you not?
It is a categorical challenge. That's correct. We don't believe that there are things about some 14-year-olds that allow a court to make this determination. We have also argued...
So the nature of the crime, I mean, you talked about life in prison without parole as being applied to serial killers. Now, as horrific as this particular crime is, it involves one victim. So your principle is that it could, a juvenile who is 14 could kill everyone in this room, and they would still not be eligible for life in prison without parole. Is that right?
That's right. That is just as in Roper, you had someone convicted of a very, very aggravated capital crime that has all the worst features that Missouri law permits, that recognizes. The court said juvenile status is relevant in a way that we cannot make a judgment that they should get the death penalty, just in the same way. And the reason for
is that a rational result for the people of this country?
Your Honor, I think it is, just in the same way that an 8-year-old could kill everybody in this room, a 5-year-old. There is a minimum age at which we cannot, consistent with our Constitution, impose these kinds of punishments because they become cruel. There is a minimum age, and that's all that this issue in this case presents. It's the question about where that minimum age is. I don't think anyone...
Well, if you prevail in this case, won't you be arguing couple of years down the road that anyone under the age of 18 cannot serve life in prison without parole?
Justice Prosser, I can only argue cases where the facts and the law support them, and right now I don't have the facts or the law to make that kind of argument. I don't know where the country will go. I think the trend is very much moving against life imprisonment without parole sentence for juveniles. We've seen two states prohibit that sentence, but it may stop there. And if it stops there, then we won't be able to make that kind of argument. But here I think that we have a unique situation. I mean, if this court rules in our favor, you'll be invalidating a single sentence. And not only is this sentence...
Wait a minute. This case might go to the United States Supreme Court, however it works out. I mean, wouldn't you, in effect, invalidate the life in prison without parole sentence of Mr. Simmons?
Our argument here is that that we're talking about juveniles 14 years of age, children 14 years of age and younger. That's the argument. That's the category where we believe the objective indicia supports an Eighth Amendment analysis. It's a different analysis for older kids. There's some 2,600 juveniles, 17 and 18, who've been sentenced to life without parole. Very different analysis. 42 jurisdictions have permitted those kinds of sentences to be imposed. Very different kind. It's a different legal question than the question we're presenting here, but based on what the court has told us is the first relevant factor, these objective indicia of frequency. Here we're talking about 18 jurisdictions, 73 sentences nationwide, and kids 14 and younger. And I might add that Wisconsin, in a variety of contexts, has recognized the distinctions between kids who are under the age of 14 and kids who are older. In a variety of contexts, we've done that. And so our argument would not invalidate in this ruling, in this case, the sentence imposed in Chris Simmons' case. I see the red light is on.
You do, and you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Does anyone else on the court have any questions?
Chief, I'll save mine for rebuttal.
I'm going to ask mine now.
Sure.
You rely, it seems to me, heavily on what might be classified as a medical research or social science research, depending on the training and theory of the person. Is the court bound to only your research that you've sent, or can the court, like the Brandeis brief, look at other research and find out that what you cite is really not accepted?
Yeah. Well, the court can certainly look at other research, but, Your Honor, what we're citing and what we're talking about has actually been relied on by the United States Supreme Court. This is found in the opinion of the Supreme Court in Roper and in Graham, and so I would argue that we're really not talking purely about social science or purely about medical. We're talking about information that the United States Supreme Court has now made relevant to evaluations about the propriety of sentencing children. And that's why we believe that what the court has said in both Roper and Graham is sufficient to guide this court's analysis on this issue.
One of the hot areas of research in Wisconsin at the university, as well as across the country, is neuroscience, as I'm sure you are well aware, where distinct parts of the brain are observed and that they can be changed, not only by age, but by experience. So what the U.S. Supreme Court may have relied on a year ago or 5 years ago or whatever time period may or may not be what is evident in a fast-developing field.
Yeah, I think, Your Honor, that part of what's relevant for us, part of what's important for us, is that the predictive parts of brain development have very little utility here. We are not making predictions that all juveniles will do well in prison. We're not arguing that this is about an expectation that all kids will do great. That's not our argument. What MRI, what magnetic resonance imaging has told us, though, is that we know that they are underdeveloped in these parts of the brain that are relevant to assessing culpability and impulsivity. That's a fact. That's not going to change. We may learn that other things will influence what encourages good development and inhibit good development, but I don't think that's critical or relevant to the question before this court.
You're not arguing they have to be given parole at any particular time, just the opportunity for parole.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. If there are no questions, I'll reserve the time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stevenson. You have 5 minutes. Sally Wellman, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin.
Yes, may it please the Court. I am Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman, representing the state in this case. We would ask the Court to hold that the Eighth Amendment and the Wisconsin Constitution do not categorically prohibit life without parole for the crime of intentional homicide committed by a 14-year-old. First of all, that holding is not required by any United States Supreme Court precedent or the rationale of Roper or Graham. Obviously, Roper involved only the death penalty, which is and always has been in a class by itself in terms of what crimes and what kinds of persons the state may impose that penalty on. Graham involved only non-homicides, and that distinction is important, not just because Mr. Graham happened to have committed a non-homicide, obviously that was the fact of the case, but in its analysis, the United States Supreme Court in Graham made it very clear that in determining whether this particular penalty, life without parole, which is severe but not the death penalty, we have to look at life without parole for what? For what offense? And the court demonstrated, as its cases had, that it has always treated in Eighth Amendment jurisprudence causing the death of another person with intent differently from any other crime. It is more morally reprehensible, and it can be treated as more morally reprehensible even if the person who committed it is a juvenile. In Roper, the court did not directly address whether life without parole would be unconstitutional for a juvenile under the age of 18. But it did by upholding the lower court decision in that case, which was to vacate the death penalty and impose life without parole. It upheld that result. Moreover, in its discussion of deterrence, it specifically said that to the extent that the argument is being made that we need the death penalty to deter juveniles from committing these horrendous crimes, life without parole is sufficient because it is a very, very severe penalty. So I think you can combine that to say that they at least did not just blithely dismiss the issue. Now, in Graham, again, the court specifically looked at and carved out its discussion of homicide and said we have always treated homicide differently. And it is our argument that we cannot categorically say that no 14-year-old, no matter how heinous and horrific the offense, no matter what kind of sophisticated adult lifestyle he is living, no matter what his other crimes, no matter how unremorseful he is, no 14-year-old who intentionally kills another person can ever be deserving of the sentence of life without parole. The two justifications for that, penological justifications for that, that we are entitled to depend on are retribution and incapacitation.
Counsel, what, if any, role do you think the victim's perspective should play here in the court's analysis? As a trial court judge, I can tell you it is exceedingly difficult to sentence people, and particularly in cases where you have a young person that you are essentially deciding the rest of their life. But you also have the competing interest of the victim and the victim's family and the fact that their child will never have a chance ever to have parole or anything. And so, you know, I understand that we're only dealing with the defendant here, but what, if any, role or importance should this court give to the fact that really the family of the victim has zero possibility of their child coming back into this world in any form, in any way, and participate in life in any fashion, even from prison, right?
Right. And I think I have a couple of answers to that. First, in terms of the harm to the victim, not just this particular victim's family, but the victim in the large sense of the community, that a life of another person has been taken by this defendant. Nothing can change that. That is why homicide can be treated differently and why we can exact retribution, even on a 14-year-old, for that crime. It goes to the very heart of that. Now, to the extent that you may be also asking about the particular victim's family's viewpoint of what the sentence should be, that would go to a case-by-case analysis. I don't think it factors into the constitutional analysis, but it certainly would for the individual trial court, and that's appropriate for the individual trial court under Wisconsin law.
In other words, the Eighth Amendment doesn't consider the victim. Is that your point?
It considers the harm done by the crime, and that considers the harm to the victim.
Which is killing.
Yes.
But beyond that, whether the victim was at fault or did something that doesn't justify the crime, but is taken into account maybe in sentencing, or the age of the victim, or how many brothers, sisters, children the victim has, it's not an Eighth Amendment issue.
That's my understanding of the Eighth Amendment case law. I've never seen it broken down to that level of characteristics of the victim or the crime.
It's the homicide, a first degree intentional homicide.
Right.
That's the issue in the Eighth Amendment in terms of the punishment.
Yes.
The categorical method.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
in
the last.
In what we're dealing is in a categorical classification.
Yes, right. And as our
to be clear, counsel, the current state of the statutes do not require a mandatory imposition of life in prison without the possibility of parole for homicides committed by juveniles. True?
That's true. We don't require it for anyone.
And that is because the legislature has made the determination, it seems to me, that it is the trial court that is in the best position to determine the appropriate sentence. As in this case, Judge McKay, I think any review of the transcripts would indicate that he worked very hard to search the record and receive input that was presented by both the defense as well as the representatives of the victims. And he made a determination based on all of the relevant and appropriate statutory factors and then pronounced sentence. Is there anything to indicate that Judge McKay did not follow the appropriate statutes in imposing this sentence?
Absolutely not.
One of the parts of your brief that I found interesting, and I assume you will get to it, and if it flows more orderly I'll ask you to address it.
That's fine.
The historical perspective. At the time the Constitution was signed, what would the possibility of sentences have been for the defendant in this case?
It would have been the same as an adult because there was no separate juvenile system.
So in other words, the death penalty would have been a possibility.
When the death penalty existed, yes. Beyond that, the highest sentence, life without parole, they didn't use that terminology then, but life imprisonment. There was no parole system, so I have to assume at that time life meant life also.
So the argument advanced here is that as the times have changed, our understanding of the different developmental capacities of different individuals have changed as well, and so therefore what wasn't considered cruel at the time of the signing of the Constitution should now be considered cruel.
I think that's correct, although the U.S. Supreme Court cases have not really gone back and looked at the history of the United States Constitution in this line of death penalty cases.
Are you familiar with the studies that your opposing counsel has referenced in support of his client?
I have read everything that he has cited.
Is there anything to indicate that all human beings develop at the same rate? In other words, what about the adults? What about those well over 18 in their 20s, 30s? As a former trial court, it is not unknown to see those even older than in their 30s or 40s who appear to have developed their decision-making capacity and their ability to reflect on the consequences of their actions at a reasonable person would classify at a delayed rate. Do all human beings develop at the same capacity? And if so, if not, what role should that have in our determination today?
Well, they absolutely do not, and that is one thing that's very clear from all of these studies, is that when we're talking about adolescent brain development, we're talking generalities, that at certain ranges of age, the brain generally is developed this way and that way with more of this material and less of that and less and more connections between things. No one that I have read or that he has cited has said, we can say as to an individual, even if we took an MRI moments after the offense, we can say that this individual's brain brought him to a certain level of maturity or immaturity. It's all generalized. And the brain research aspect of it, the MRIs are new, but the concept is not new. Thompson recognized that in 1988. Juveniles are different. They're generally less culpable. That doesn't mean that every juvenile is at the same level at every point in time. So while it's generally relevant to a categorical standpoint, it cannot be used to individualize and say, well, then we can know that this specific juvenile was less culpable because of his brain at that time. Obviously, even juveniles who are 13 and 14-year-olds, who are generally less mature than older adolescents or adults, they obviously are not being controlled by their emotions all of the time or unable to control their behavior all of the time. And no one that I have read or seen anything cited says we can causally attribute this crime happened because of this person's level of brain development.
Counsel, apparently at the time of
beginning of our statehood, six under the law, five-year-olds or six-year-olds or seven-year-olds could be subject to the death penalty, but we're not there anymore. But where we are, as I understand it, is that under current Wisconsin law, that a 10-year-old could be sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Would your argument be any different here today if we were dealing with a 10-year-old?
No, because we do not believe that the Constitution requires or gives this court any basis to draw that categorical line for the crime of intentional homicide. And again, that's because intentional homicide, the state has the right to exact retribution, even on a 14-year-old, even on a 10-year-old, if the trial court would find under all the circumstances that that would be appropriate, considering all of the factors.
If the state allowed less than 10 years old, which it does not in Wisconsin now, but let's say it went to the days of statehood in 1848, did not have a barrier with regard to life without parole or, at that time, apparently capital punishment. For a seven-year-old, do you think that might offend the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution?
Not the Eighth Amendment, no. It obviously would be a factor the trial court would consider in individualized sentencing. But as long as our law says the person is capable of forming intent, and there is not like an insanity defense where he's not capable of knowing right from wrong, if he meets that threshold of competency, I think is the word we used to use, competency to be convicted of a crime, then we do not think the Eighth Amendment prohibits a term of years, which is what life without parole is.
Graham seems to be stepping away from what you're saying, though. Graham, as I read it, indicates that, you know, the sentencing judge sitting there years earlier, the prejudgments of young juveniles is what is violative of the Constitution. And it speaks of a judge determining that a juvenile would be incorrigible, and that characteristic of juveniles make the judge's judgment questionable, you know, and it goes on to say, as I'm sure you're familiar, talks about, you know, even the psychologists aren't able to differentiate oftentimes at the young age of the juvenile what's going to transpire 30, 40, 50, 60 years from now.
Right. I have a couple of responses to that. One, Graham did not try to draw lines between ages, so they said everyone under 18. So that does not support Defendant Ninnem's theory that there should be a line between 14 and younger and older than 14. Two, Graham, again, was limited to non-homicides. And I think when you're dealing with a class of homicides, a bunch of felonies that were non-homicides. Let me clarify that. Non-homicides. It's easier to say, I think, that it's harder for a trial court to say, well, for this range of homicides, we can predict or not predict whether the person will be able to change or should have any opportunity to change. But our primary argument is, first and foremost, that when it is a homicide, retribution alone is enough. Trial courts in Wisconsin are legislatively authorized and not constitutionally prohibited from saying to an individual, under all the circumstances of the offense and the characteristics of the individual, even though you are 14, for taking the life of this other person in the horrific way in which you did, for which you have shown no remorse, and your post-assault, post-murder conduct has continued to be threatening to other people and showing no remorse, you as an individual, we have a right to say to you, you deserve to never have the opportunity to live in free society again. That's retribution.
Counsel, if I heard Mr. Stevenson correctly, he characterized the events that led to Mr. Ninnem's conviction as a manifestation of typical adolescent behavior, of bullying. I think it is worthwhile to ask you, what does the record show us actually occurred here?
Well, I certainly would disagree with the characterization that this is typical adolescent behavior of bullying. It certainly became a bullying incident. As I recall the facts of the case, the young victim, who was 13, was simply going to the grocery store to pick up something that his older brother had asked him to pick up to finish making dinner for the family, coming home with his bag, which I believe had tomatoes in it, and the defendant and his cohorts, just for absolutely no reason, he didn't know him, he hadn't done anything, knocked him off his bike, chased him up a parking ramp, and then the defendant, Ninham, and one of the other boys, Ricky Carpo, I believe it's pronounced, it's my best guess, played what they call, one of the witnesses called, monkey in between or something, where one of them would hit him and shove him between the other one. So he's just trapped between these two boys who are brutalizing him, terrorizing him. And then Ninham and Ricky picked him up, held him over the outside of the parking ramp, swung him back and forth. At least one of the witnesses testified that he was screaming, crying, begging for his life, don't let me go, don't throw me, don't drop me, and they threw him over. That is not typical adolescence behavior. It may be that in non-homicide felonies, even robberies and burglaries, it may be that many, many juveniles grow out of that adolescent misbehavior. We don't think that the people of Wisconsin and the legislature of Wisconsin are required to take the chance or to make the assumption or to give a 14-year-old the opportunity to show he has grown out of committing this kind of horrific homicide.
Ms. Wellman, let me, if I might, shift you to another issue here.
Certainly.
And that's an issue having to do with whether or not the judge applied an inappropriate factor in sentencing. That inappropriate factor being what the family had testified to or asked for, and that was the freeing of the soul of the victim. Now, there's no question from the transcript that Judge McKay referred to that, indicated that he was being asked to free the soul of the victim. Was that, in your opinion, in the opinion of opposing counsel, that's an inappropriate factor to be looking at? It's a religious factor to be looking at. In your opinion, is that an inappropriate factor?
It was not, the way Judge McKay used it.
Why?
He commented on it that it was unusual and how striking it was to him that he was being asked to do this, not only to sentence, but to free a soul. That was simply this victim's family's very sincere and heartfelt way of expressing the utter depth of their loss of their 13-year-old son and brother and family member. Judge McKay didn't say, I must give this sentence because now I feel obligated to free your soul. He mentioned it in expressing the harm that had been done to this victim's family by killing the victim. He also mentioned it because it did show a contrast, or it showed the interesting cultural difference dynamics that were going on here, where Ninham was using his own, what he called his own spiritual growth and his own Native American spirituality. He was using that in his defense report, sentencing report, to show that he had grown and he was making some progress. He also was using it, he was saying, I was never there. I'm trying to make use of some dreams through my spirituality to determine where I was at the time of the homicide. Therefore, you know, denying he did the crime and obviously showing absolutely no remorse. So it was only in that sense that the judge made a passing reference. Obviously, basing a sentence based on either the religion of the victim or the defendant could in some circumstances certainly be an inappropriate factor, no question about that. But it was not in this case, reading the entire transcript as a whole.
Counsel, if I might, I heard you say that retribution alone is enough. Now, putting on my trial court judge hat, I'm thinking it's not. I'm thinking it might hold the day, it might be an overriding factor, but it is one thing a judge looks at, not the only thing. that a judge looks at. Do you really mean to say that a judge can solely look at retribution? That's it? End the day with that? And I don't think that's been our precedent when it comes to exercising discretion in a sentencing determination.
Right. I did not mean to say that the judge can only look at that. I'm saying as a penological justification for the categorical, to defeat the categorical prohibition argument that's being made, the state of Wisconsin can rely on retribution as its justification. We also rely on incapacitation, but we believe retribution alone is enough. The sentencing court obviously has been told for years and years by this court that it must consider gravity of the offense, character of the offender, and need to protect the public. I believe that retribution falls most closely within the gravity of the offense. And then having considered all of those, it can base its sentence on any one of those, if that answers your question.
Thank you.
Could I ask you a question? I don't know quite how to consider this. There are these studies about brain development. If we were to accept without dispute those studies, how does the fact that the defendant used massive amounts of alcohol and possibly drugs, how does that interact with the studies? Doesn't that almost invalidate any study?
Well, I'm not sure. I know there are, the defendant cites one source that says, well, studies have shown that even children who have consumed alcohol or have fetal alcohol syndrome as children, later, if they're kept alcohol-free for a long enough period of time, can perform almost as well as people who didn't. I don't know what perform means in that sense. I don't know if it means perform on some specific task as opposed to can be as mature and responsible. So I don't know the answer to that. There is no claim, there has never been a claim by Ninham that he was actually under the influence of alcohol at the time of this offense. So I'm not sure what role that plays in his culpability for this offense. And I'm not sure I completely understood your question, so perhaps I didn't answer it.
Well, I reading his sentencing memorandum talks about, according to Omer Ninham, he was 14 at the time of the offense on September 24, 1968. He consumed a 12-pack of beer, a half pint of brandy, two 48-ounce bottles of Old English. Now, he may have changed that story, but at least at different times he talked about having consumed a lot of alcohol that day.
Right. He never used that as any kind of a defense at trial because he didn't testify and he claimed he wasn't there. I mean, he didn't defend on any ground that alcohol was a factor in the crime, is what I meant to say.
Well, let me ask you a delicate question. Was this a hate crime?
It was not charged as a hate crime, and I don't think there is definitive evidence in the record.
May I ask you a question?
Sorry.
Do you read the plaintiff's brief here to assert both an on-the-face challenge to the statute as well as applied?
I do.
And we've been mostly talking about categorical.
Right. He certainly has never made traditional Harmelin versus Michigan proportionality analysis as, you know, as an individual sentence along that line. And I think that that would obviously fail if he had, because the first thing you look at is, regardless of the circumstances or particulars of the individual, just look at the crime and the sentence. And he's not saying that for the crime of intentional homicide, standalone, life without parole is too severe. So we don't see that. I do want to mention, and I think one of you picked this up on the questioning of defense counsel, although he is saying that he would not be bringing this argument if it were just a long, long sentence, a sentence of 40 years or 60 years, excuse me, or 50 years, or as to juveniles who are 18 or under. We are already seeing the brain research being argued as a new factor, not an Eighth Amendment analysis, but just so you're aware, as a new factor in other sentencing cases. There's one case in the Court of Appeals, State versus LaRue, I think it's L-A and then capital R-U-E, in which the Court of Appeals has held the case in abeyance pending the court's decision in Ninham, in which the defendant got like a 40-year, now he was sentenced under current law, so a 40-year, not parole eligibility date, but truth in sentencing date. What's the word I'm searching for?
Conditional release.
Term of extended supervision, thank you. A 40-year extended supervision date for committing attempted homicide when he was an adolescent. And he's claiming, well, now the studies show that even though teens mature later than we thought, they are fully mature, have full brain development by mid-20s at latest. So I've already reached mid-20s, so that should be a new factor for sentencing because now my brain is fully matured. We're also seeing at least one defendant who pled guilty to a crime when he was a juvenile. He was either waived or charged under adult jurisdiction, pled guilty. He's now saying the brain adolescent research science, because juveniles have less developed brains, I couldn't make a knowing, voluntary, intelligent plea, even though it would have met the standards if I were an adult. Other states are seeing challenges where the claim is being made that all of this research about adolescent brain development should be used to create a different insanity defense for juveniles. It should be, the jury should be told about it to take it in account as a factor for determining whether the individual juvenile had the requisite intent for the crime charged. So, obviously, we don't want to just, you know, throw out there, well, you're going to open up the door to all kinds of stuff if you do this. But I think you need to be aware that it is not limited to this context if we're looking at this kind of social science. I also do want to say my recollection is, and I could certainly be wrong because there were a lot of material cited by the defense and in the amici briefs, but I don't recall reading in the things they cited any studies that particularly looked at violent juvenile offenders who had committed homicide or who had been confined for a long time as a specific study of their brain development.
That was my question exactly.
I don't recall any of those. There are certainly studies that looked at, and there are a couple of, and there should be, I suppose there's a difference between a study where they say, you know, we took this group of people and we did this kind of testing of them and we controlled for this and this and this. I think of that as a study, as opposed to just a report or a policy piece, which some of the materials were. At least a couple of the policy pieces, I'll call them, talked about juveniles who are serving life without parole sentences, that they were sentenced to as juveniles for homicides, and how they have matured and grown, at least within the prison walls. And they're now, you know, they've gotten their education and they've gotten their college degree and they go out and they talk to young people, or they talk to young people, I suppose, in the institution, about how this was not the way to go. You need to change your life. That's all well and good. But certainly for the crime of homicide, Wisconsin does not have to take the risk of allowing a person to be eligible for parole for doing what this person has done, for doing any intentional homicide, at the age of 14. We leave that to the trial court's discretion. And if we cannot predict perfectly, we can draw distinctions between homicides, the more egregious and the horrific one committed here. We do not believe that the Wisconsin or United States Constitution requires a categorical prohibition of a sentence of life without parole for a 14-year-old who committed first-degree intentional homicide. We think the sentence was sustainable on the record in this case, and there was no abuse of discretion, there was no improper factor, and the new brain adolescent research is not a new factor for sentence modification purposes.
Thank you, Ms. Wellman. Are there any questions for Ms. Wellman? Thank you, Ms. Wellman.
Thank you.
Mr. Stevenson, that alarm, if it's prompt, will go off in seconds, so why don't we just hold you until we complete that. Thank you. I think they're announcing that it's going as a test. It's not very audible here. Well, that wasn't as bad as I portrayed, but that's unusual. So I am now torn in deciding whether to ask the marshal to tell everyone that we appreciate the new muffled sound, or let it go, because if we say that, they'll turn up the juice on it. So that isn't my most important decision today, but it's in the background. Mr. Stevenson.
Thank you. I'd like to first start by saying it is certainly not my position that this crime in any way exhibits typical juvenile behavior. There are features to this crime that I think are very that distinguish it from many adult crimes, needlessly, senselessly chasing a peer, bullying that child, and then tragically throwing them off a wall. It has some features that are distinct from what we see in most adult crimes, but that is not to say that there's anything typical or appropriate or adolescent-like in the tragic consequences. Secondly, I think the state's argument about retribution is simply not persuasive here. The United States Supreme Court has made clear that retribution as a legitimation for these kinds of extreme sentences is simply inadequate when we are assessing juvenile culpability. That was the state's primary argument in Roper. It was rejected by the Supreme Court. It was the state's argument in Graham. It was rejected by the Supreme Court. It should be rejected by this court. The Wisconsin legislature has said that a sentence of life with parole eligibility after 20 years adequately satisfies the retributive requirements for first-degree murder, because they've authorized that. They've given judges discretion, but in giving that discretion, they have said that retribution may be satisfied by imposing a life sentence with parole eligibility after 20 years. And so it's not sufficient to say that retribution resolves this case. Next, it is important to recognize that the question here is not a policy question. The state attempts to kind of suggest that the walls of justice will come tumbling down if we deal with this question in a forthright way. There are policy questions that other decision makers are going to have to grapple with as we deal with the new understanding about juvenile development and juvenile brain science. And there are other factors that are going to shape our thinking about how to deal with some of these policy issues. But that's not the question before this court. The question before this court is a constitutional question. Does the Wisconsin Constitution and the Eighth Amendment permit a sentence of life without parole on a child of 14, despite the fact that it is very unusual, that it is very rare, and that we know things and understand things about children that distinguish them and protect them and have in Roper and Graham required us to find that they cannot be sentenced in such a way.
Counsel, can I just clarify one thing? Are you making an as-applied challenge at all?
We are, Your Honor. We are arguing that this court should consider this as a categorical question, but we're also arguing two as-applied points. One, that in this particular case, the evidence about Omer and his background and circumstances, combined with what we now know and understand about child status and developmental status, through the light of Graham, through the light of Roper, dictates that his sentence should be modified. We next argue that what we now know and understand about juvenile status and development is a new factor subject to Wisconsin law's requirement that would frustrate the sentence or require review. And we think both of those things would justify a sentence here. And just as quick, we have also argued that the judge did improperly consider the suggestion that the religious status or ethnic views of the victim were relevant for the purposes of sentencing. There's been a lot of discussion during the state's argument about how we ought to just let individual judges make these determinations in individual cases. That was the argument again in Graham and Roper. Chief Justice Roberts and Graham took that position. It was rejected by the majority in Graham, I think for very solid reasons. And it has a lot to do with the fact that we cannot make the kind of informed, legitimate, constitutional judgment about the future of kids, and it doesn't matter how good a judge we're talking about. It just can't be done. And that's the reason why the court has embraced a categorical approach. It's also worth noting, and we haven't emphasized this, but it's worth noting that the other problem with that kind of proportionality review, that kind of individual case review, is that frequently there are factors that shape these judgments that are not legitimate. Of the 73 children, as we cited in our report, that have been sentenced to life without parole in this country for crimes 14 and younger, 75% of them are kids of color. There are these other factors. There are these other influences that shape that kind of judgment. And that's the reason why the court has also said that these are unusual sentences for kids. We are not arguing that all kids under the age of 18 are subject to this remedy. And I want to just be very clear that the distinction that we're making for kids 14 and younger, kids younger than older adolescents, has been recognized by the United States Supreme Court. The Supreme Court of the United States struck down the death penalty for kids 15 and younger 20 years ago. In 1988, in Thompson versus Oklahoma, the court said no, because these kids 15 and younger have been sentenced to death, and we find something distinct about that. We're going to ban the death penalty for them. A year later, they said it was constitutional to impose the death penalty for kids who are 16. And so these age distinctions didn't come out of out of nowhere. They are recognized in Supreme Court jurisprudence. The reason why it doesn't have the same effect in kids who are older and in Simmons is because, again, as I've stated, it's a different inquiry there. 2,500 juveniles, 16, 17, and 18, sentenced to life without parole in this country. 42 states. Those data put it outside of the Supreme Court's analysis when it comes to recognizing an Eighth Amendment violation. Consequently, the decision that this court makes in Ninham will apply to these very limited circumstances, these very unusual circumstances involving very young children who are 14 and younger. As I've said, only one child in the state of Wisconsin, only 73 children across the country. I do think that for the purposes of assessing this issue, the evidence is quite powerful and quite clear. It's a very unusual sentence to take a child of 14 and to say we're going to sentence you to die in prison, even though we have the option of evaluating you in 10, 15, 20 years, is unusual. Wisconsin is now in the minority of jurisdictions. I also think that based on what we know and understand about children and child status, to say to any child of 14 that you are fit only to die in prison is cruel. It is incompatible with what we know and understand about children. It is incompatible with what we understand and recognize in the Eighth Amendment. And yes, the Eighth Amendment does evolve. We understand things now about the status of women and the status of people of color and other things that we didn't understand 150 years ago. And as a result of that, we would ask this court to reverse the lower court and hold that this violates the Eighth Amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stevenson. Thank you, Mr. and Ms. Wellman. Excellent arguments and briefs today on a very important issue that is across the country as well as in Wisconsin. And Mr. Stevenson, you're no longer eligible to practice in Wisconsin, at least for the time being, until readmitted. Thank you for coming. That concludes our hearing at 09-AP-538, Killian versus, I'm sorry, State versus Ninham. And we'll take a brief recess so that the students here may leave and other students and others may enter the courtroom. We're in recess.